And my goal for today is to review a little bit about the narrative of the book of Esther. And we'll explore some of the culture of something called Purim, which is a holiday that's mentioned in the scriptures. Jesus observed it. It's kept by the Jews to the present day, all in the celebration of the book of Esther and the events that surround it. And we're also going to answer a fascinating mystery that surrounds the book of Esther. For you see, the name of God, at least the way we read it, is not to be found in the book of Esther. And to the uninformed spectator, some have even speculated whether or not the book of Esther should even be in the Bible. Well, I will show you that that's an incorrect speculation. We will discover that there's something hidden not only in the book of Esther, but there's something hidden in our lives and something that we can apply to our lives in the current time. Now, I have an attorney. His name is Matthew Judah Shahan. It's a really good Jewish name. He's on the board of his local synagogue. He's a longtime customer of mine. I've known Matt since he was a young man. I actually used to do business with his father as well. And Matt will argue two of my favorite topics. And in the Jewish tradition, argument is an art form, and Matt enjoys a good argument. He has friends, of course. And his two favorite topics are baseball, which I love, and as a baseball historian, and he is as well. And he likes to debate religion. And so one of the things, he'll get me on a religious point now and then when we debate. So my touche is always to go to Matt and say, hey, outside of Sandy Koufax, how many Jewish players are in there in the Baseball Hall of Fame? Right. I joke with him, and I mean this in love. But I just go, you know, the Jewish Baseball Hall of Fame could fit in a broom closet, whereas Cooperstown goes on for an acre, right? And so he gets back and forth, and we give and take in love and male bonding type of a way. But Matt has shared with me some of the customs of the synagogue about Purim. And this goes on in virtually all the synagogues, whether they're Reform or Orthodox or liberal. They love this holiday. It's kind of a neat celebration that they have. Purim happens right before the Passover season. This year it would have been in March. All right. So not that long ago. We're sort of still in that season when Purim is normally celebrated. And some of the customs that they have, I think, are kind of cool. I'd like to do some of those today. And timely for this type of season here, post-Passover and post-Days of Unleavened Bread. But let's take a look at before I go to a scripture, I'll tell you what one of the customs are. The bad guy in the book of Esther is a man named Haman. Haman, you actually jumped the gun. All right, what they do in the synagogue is they dress up. And they have different customs. The little girls like to dress up like Queen Esther. And the men can dress up like, the boys will dress up like Mordecai and the like. But dressing up like Queen Esther is really a cool thing. So they have the little pretty gowns, little crowns and whatnot. And in the synagogue, when they speak of the book of Esther, whenever the name of Haman is mentioned, he is villainized. Now, one of the things they do is they write the name Haman on the bottom of their shoe. And I did that today. You can take a look. There it is. I did that. There it is. And in Middle Eastern culture as a whole, let alone Jewish culture, the bottom of the foot is considered a very bad place. Now, remember, clean streets is a fairly modern phenomenon. I mean, even in New York in the 1920s, they still had horses somewhat, you know, doing milk wagons and whatnot. Streets are a dirty place. The bottom of your shoe, bad place, right? I don't want to be too graphic on that. But not a nice sanitary place. And to this day in the Middle East, and anciently, the bottom of the shoe, bad news. I remember back when Saddam Hussein fell, they had a giant statue of him, all right? And they helped pull it down with ropes. Some of our troops helped, but they pulled it down. And when that statue was being dragged through the streets, Everybody was taking off their shoe and banging on this thing, right? Here's what we think about Saddam. We're going to bang you with the bottom of our filthy shoe. And there was a time when even our president, George Bush, went to Iraq. And, you know, somebody wanted to protest that. They took off their shoe and they threw it at him, all right? So they got a shoe thing going on. I don't totally understand it. You know, in the book of Ruth, there was this contract that's made, and proof of delivery was you had to give a shoe. Now, I guess that's a pretty good thing, you know, outside of a written contract or something filed at the courthouse. If you have somebody's shoe, you've been intimate with that person. I tried to steal Larry Sharp's shoe, and it didn't work real well. Anyway, he kind of punched me. So anyway, there's something about shoes. Again, I can't relate to it totally in the modern culture, but it's there. And one of the other things they do in the temple is whenever the name Haman is spoken, and I'd like to try this, and we can go over to Esther 3, verse 11. Esther 3, verse 11. Whenever the name Haman is spoken, the people in the audience will hiss and they boo. Remember, this is the bad guy. This guy wanted to kill all the Jews. They hiss and they boo. They have a little instrument called a grogger, and I got one, and I gave a few of you out here. And the grogger's a little noisemaker. So whenever the name Haman is spoken, you boo, you hiss, and you do your grogger. All right? So let's just try it. We'll try it once. I don't want to distract from the sermon too much, but I wanted to do it once. All right? So we'll read from Esther 3, verse 11. All right? The king said to Haman, boo! They were into interactive. That's their form of Bible chat. All right. I thought it was kind of cool. Anyway, I wanted to bring that to you, and I thought it was kind of neat. But let's move on in this. It says, the king said to Haman, the silver is yours, and the people also. Do unto them as you please. And this is when Haman had plotted to remove the Jews because of jealousy and the like. And the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. The 13th day of the first month. Does that ring a bell? When is the 13th day of the when is the 14th day of the first month? That's Passover. And here is Haman on the 13th day of the first month doing this terrible plot. And I'll imply that Haman was a type of Judas. History repeats itself. History tends to run in cycles. The cast of characters seem to come about over and over again. And we'll see even in the modern time that some of the same issues and same type of characters exist even today. On the 13th day of the first day, it was written just as Haman commanded to kings, to the governors, and to those who were over every province, and to the princes of the people, each province according to script, each people according to its own language, being written in the name of King Xerxes, who was the king at the time, and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent to the couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children. Why would Satan want to kill all the Jews? Why would Satan want that? Why have the Jews always been kind of a focus of Satan? That's right. Because the root of Jesse, Satan knew. He knows the scriptures better than we know them. He knew that he wanted to frustrate prophecy. He wanted to frustrate God's plan. If he could kill the Jews, he could frustrate that plan. He tried it again later on when Christ was born and a king went and made a decree to kill all the babies that were young male babies that were under the age of two. And Jesus and his family had to flee to Egypt. All right? Over and over again, we see this type of pattern. Satan doesn't give up. He just doesn't give up. But I don't think he's all that creative because he seems like he keeps trying to do the same things over and over again in spite of failure. Now, I'm inspired to speak about this topic because on the eve of Purim just last year in 2015, which was March the 3rd, 2015, and I do believe that the timing of this event was inspired. We had a visit from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And he spoke before a joint session of Congress. I think God names people or inspires names to be given. Netanyahu is a name that means God has given a gift. I find that interesting. I have a lot of respect for Benjamin Netanyahu, for his resume is very impressive. He's a man's man in a world where it's hard to find men's men. In 1967, he fought in the Six-Day War as a young 18-year-old soldier, where Israel overcame tremendous odds to win the day. And even at that young age, Netanyahu was a member of the very elite special forces. In effect, like a Green Beret or a Naval SEAL, he was in the very elite special forces. He has been wounded in battle multiple times. During the rescue of Sabena Flight 571, which was on the ground at Ben-Gurion International Airport as a hijacking, he was wounded and shot in the shoulder at that time. And so I'll tell you what, at least in my book, when a man who has those types of credentials speaks, I think it pays heed that we listen. He has the resume. He has earned the right for us to listen. And I wanted to read a portion of his Purim speech from Ben Netanyahu to the joint sessions of Congress. He said, "Thank you, America. Thank you for everything you have done for Israel. My friends, I've come here today because as Prime Minister of Israel, I feel a profound obligation to speak to you about an issue that could well threaten the survival of my country and the future of my people. And that is Iran's quest for nuclear weapons. We are an ancient people. In our nearly 4,000 years of history, many have tried to destroy the people, the Jewish people. Tomorrow night, the Jewish holiday of Purim will be read, the Book of Esther. And we'll read of a powerful Persian viceroy, an evil man named Haman, who plotted to destroy the Jewish people some 2,500 years ago. But a courageous Jewish woman, Queen Esther, exposed the plot and gave for the Jewish people the right to defend themselves against their enemies. The plot was foiled. Our people were saved. Yet today, the Jewish people face another attempt by yet another Persian potentate to destroy us. Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, spews the oldest hatred, the old hatred of anti-Semitism, but with the newest technology. He tweets that Israel will be annihilated. He tweets. You know, in Iran, there isn't exactly a free internet, but he tweets in English that Israel must be destroyed. Facing me right up there in the gallery, overlooking all of us in this chamber, is the image of Moses. And in case you didn't know, Moses is in our lawmaking. The Ten Commandments are actually listed in the Supreme Court and also in the Houses of Congress. This is Bill's commentary here, mind you. But we were a divine breed people. We really are. Once were. Moses led our people from slavery to the gates of the Promised Land. And before the people of Israel entered the land of Israel, Moses gave a message to us that steeled our resolve for thousands of years. And I leave you with this message today. And I'll translate it. He said this in Hebrew at the time. I'll translate it. He said, "Be strong and resolute. Neither fear nor dread them. Do not fear your enemies. My friends, may Israel and America, may we always stand together, strong and resolute. May we neither fear nor dread the challenges that are ahead. May we face the future with confidence and strength and hope. May God bless the state of Israel. And may God bless the United States of America." And I'll tell you what, brethren, I was inspired when I saw that speech. Thank you for letting me share that. It's part of the sermon. But I personally feel that that speech will go down in history as one of the most important speeches of our era. For he was bringing attention to us something that we don't want to pay attention to. For we live in very dangerous times. Very, very dangerous times. And us as Christians and as believers, we must have high sobriety. For the times are dangerous. And yes, I understand that for decades we've been hoping and expecting and praying for the second coming of Jesus Christ. And it's easy to get worn out with that. But I do say it's high time that we be very aware and not be virgins that sleep. Because we live in profound times, brethren, we really do. For it's certainly only a matter of time that Iran will be producing a nuclear weapon. And that's a fact. And when they do, there will be pressure on all the other nations in that area. Because you realize that the Middle East is not a united religion. It's not one common enemy. There's great hatred amongst the different nations, the different groups, the Sunni, the Shia, the Wahhabi, and the like. And if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, you can be rest assured Saudi Arabia will want to have a nuclear weapon as well, because they are not kindred souls, religiously or politically. No friend to Iran is Egypt or even Syria. And they too will get nuclear weapons. And I want to ask you, brethren, knowing what we know about the Bible, imagine such a volatile area armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. I shudder to think. It's scary, a very scary thought. Going back to the book of Esther, those events happened back in 483 to 473 BC during the first half of the reign of King Xerxes, who chose Esther to be his queen. And during this time, the first remnant of Jews had returned to Judah, where they were struggling to establish a temple for worship, according to the law of Moses. But there were still these Jews that were in Persia. Esther and Mordecai, along with many other Jews, had chosen not to make the trek back to Judah. They seemed content to stay in Persia. And they chose as their home a town called Susa, the capital city of Persia, where the story is set. Haman, our villain, he was the prime minister. And he was well acquainted with political intrigue and power climbing. He didn't realize there's a God who sets up those that rule. Even today, I think we forget that God sets up who the leaders are going to be and who they are not going to be. But Haman thought it's politics, power, bribes. And he was very good at that, very acquainted with that. But the word Purim itself means dice. And what was determined for when this persecution was going to start, the 13th day of the first month, it was determined through the toss of dice. But I think God himself inspired what date that was going to be. And that was when, of course, the slaughter of the Jews was to take place. Orphaned as a child and brought up by her cousin Mordecai, Esther was selected by King Xerxes to replace a queen, Queen Vashti, when she refused to dance for the king. And I don't blame her. He wanted her to do something that was very illicit. Women were viewed as chattel. She was asked to humiliate herself, and she refused to do it. And to replace her was Queen Esther. Haman, the prime minister, persuaded the king to issue a decree to kill all the Jews in the Persian Empire. And we asked, well, why? And that's because Mordecai refused to bow to him. Here he was climbing up the political ladder and so forth. And Mordecai was a well-respected man, a well-respected elder. But he was not going to bow down to Haman. And men of that type, they hold grudge and they remember. He goes, you know what? This man potentially could be an enemy. This man potentially could be a rival. This man potentially and his people, right? I will eliminate them. That was his plan. That was Haman's plan. So then Haman, the prime minister, persuaded the king to issue a decree to kill all the Jews in the Persian Empire. Esther 3, verse 1. Esther 3, verse 1. And after these things did King Xerxes promote Haman and advanced him and set a seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. For for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not. I want you to remember that. Mordecai refused to bow. We may be asked to bow someday, brethren. Maybe not literally bow, but we will be asked to submit. But Mordecai would not submit. Nor did he give him reverence. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's commandment? Verse 4. And it came to pass, when they spoke daily to him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor to give him reverence, then Haman was full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes, even the people of Mordecai. Again, we live in amazing times, brethren. I reel. And I'm a man of the modern era. I've seen a lot of things happen in my short 58 years. And even then, the acceleration is incredible. They're dizzying how fast our culture is changing, how fast the social norms are changing. In a matter of months, issues are being brought up that we weren't even talking about. No one was talking about. Not even the liberal press. And yet, in a similar time, Mordecai stood fast. He would not bow nor reverence the unholy. As Christians today, we're facing choices that I never thought would come. Not to belabor it, but who would imagine that you might be forced to bake a cake for an unholy religious ceremony, that you would be forced to do that, or lose your livelihood, or to take photos of an event that is an unholy event. And if you don't do it, your business will be blackballed. You'll be out of a job. If you don't go along with this on the work and so forth, or you dare to open your mouth or say anything against such a thing, you're going to be out the door. It's the era we live in. My parents were not religious in the least. We never went to church. But we still had what I call the Christian hangover in America. They would be shocked if they were alive today. They weren't even religious. People from the 50s and 60s would pass out for the things that we are having to be expected to endure in society today, and that would be considered normal and actually to be considered proper. My folks would pass out. They wouldn't believe it. But we're to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. That's what it says in Matthew 10, verse 16. Wise as serpents, gentle as doves. Their times are coming soon where we're going to have to take some stands, brethren. And it's not going to be easy. And it certainly wasn't easy for Mordecai. But he remained steadfast and sure. And we shall too in the future. But not because of our own strength or because we're strong-backed, weak-minded German guy or Irish or strong or whatever we think we are because we're tough. No, it will only happen because of the strength that God will give us. We will not handle this alone. We need God's help. So part of my message is I implore you to seek the strength of Jesus Christ, God the Father, the power of the Holy Spirit, to live in your life, because that is where we will only find the ability to endure to the end. Esther and Mordecai, though, had good favor with the king, who was not aware of her Jewish background, which was kept away, a secret from King Haman. And Esther, who was acting on Mordecai's advice, endangered her own life by appearing before the king, uninvited, to plead for the lives of the people. And again, to give us some cultural relevance, Terry can say anything she wants to me. Modern women. And I don't mind. I like it. We're good friends. That is not the way it worked in those days. You didn't go uninvited to the king and say, hey, you know, I'd like some extra money for groceries this week. It didn't work that way. All right? Women were viewed as chattel. Women were viewed as, you know, to be seen and not heard. And for her to be so bold as to appear before the king uninvited, you know, supposed to be beckon Queen Esther to come unto the court. All right, so this, she was literally taking her life in her hands by doing this. This was a very brave thing that she did. Uninvited, she pleaded for the lives of her people. And in this, she was acting in faith and in courage. Something we need. Seeing that she was in the king's good graces, she invited both the king and Haman to a great banquet. And Haman thought that this was supposed to be an honor. Oh, we're going to have a big banquet. I will go. And there will be Queen Esther and King Haman, King Xerxes. And he thought, hey, this is great. Invited to this nice banquet. And that he was in Esther's good favor. But her real intention was to expose Haman for the slimy guy that he was. During a second banquet, Queen Esther reveals her Jewish origin to the king, which he was not aware of at the time, and then pleads for her life and for those of her people. Angry with Haman, the king steps into the palace garden to think it over. She kind of steps out in the little foyer, like, what's going on here? Let me think this over. Leaving Queen Esther and Haman alone there for a little bit. By this time now, Haman was in a great panic. The gig is up. He feared for his life. And he ran over to Queen Esther to plead for his life. And while frantically imploring, Haman casts himself upon Esther. She's on a couch, laying there. And he throws himself on, please, no, please, no. And the king, upon returning, finds Haman in this compromised position. He says, what are you? Not only are you slimy and wicked and did this plot, you're going to rape my wife? And suddenly, the gallows which had been prepared for Mordecai to be hung on was now used on Haman. And remember I said there was some parallel between Judas and Haman? On what day did Judas go to the priests to try to arrange for the death of Christ? It was on that 13th day of the first month. And like Judas later on, you know what he did? He ended up hanging himself. And what happened to Haman? He too was hung. Haman and Judas, I will propose, have a lot of parallel in the Bible. Hung by their own evil plotting. And maybe Judas had an idea that Jesus is the warrior of God, and I'll just kind of make things happen so Jesus will finally act, so that I can finally get my place, get rid of those Romans, and I'll be at the right hand of Christ. I don't know what was going through Judas's mind. But it was wicked, it was political, and it was self-serving, just like it was with Haman. And now for our mystery, because we have a mystery. Because nowhere in the book of Esther is the name of God found. And again, like I said, for that reason, some liberal scholars and a Bible apologist, I don't like that crowd. I don't even know why they bother. If they don't believe it, why are you even bothering studying it? But they've gone so far as to suggest that Esther shouldn't even be in the canon, because for that reason, it belongs in the Apocrypha. But the name of God is in Esther, but it is hidden in secret code. This is fascinating stuff, brother. Fascinating stuff. So listen up. In the Bible, there are things, codes called acrostics, hidden letters. And in Esther 1:3, right off the bat in the book of Esther, right in the beginning of the book, if you go every eighth letter, this isn't one of those things like the Bible codes where, you know, it's this, that, and the other thing, they use computers. This is very simple acrostic. Every eighth letter, right off the bat in the book of Esther, starting in verse 3, every eighth letter spells this, Yahshua HaMessiah. That means Jesus is the Messiah. Isn't that incredible? Hundreds of years before Jesus Christ, it's encoded right there at the very beginning of the book of Esther, every eighth letter. Eight meaning, of course, the new beginnings. Fascinating. In Esther 7, verse 5, also encoded in equidistant letters in Hebrew, the name is Elohim, which means God. No, God's not missing. He's just merely hidden from casual human view. God is in control, brethren. He's in control of the United Church of God. He is in control of you, and he is in control of world events. Make no doubt about it. He is there. And I find all this amazing. And I love it when you see proof of the Bible. Fulfilled prophecy, like in the book of Daniel, talking about kingdoms that were hundreds of years out. These were the things that when God was calling me, it made me realize something is going on. These things we call the Holy Scriptures are true. I don't think this was random circumstance. Jesus is the Messiah. That it was a plot to put this in here. But God is there. He has put the fingerprint of himself throughout the Scriptures. And I'm easy to convince, I guess. You know, I like old music. My wife, she says I listen to the most out-of-it music on earth. I like the old Lawrence Welk shows and the like and stuff from the 50s and 60s. But in the 1950s, there was a singer named Frankie Lane. And he had a song called I Believe. And the song I Believe, I can't sing, so I'll just read you the words. Because this applies to me, and hopefully to you. I believe above the storm, the smallest prayer will still be heard. I believe that somewhere in the great somewhere, he hears every word. Every time I hear a newborn baby cry, or touch a leaf, or see the sky. That's why I know I believe. And that's why I believe. And not just Bible acrostics, but even simple things like seeing stars in the sky and touching a leaf. I know there's a God. I know why I believe. So what's the takeaway that I want all of you to have today? I'd like for all of you to realize that you too have something hidden. The power of God's Holy Spirit resides within you. The power of God, the evidence of truth, his fingerprint, his DNA is within you. The body of Christ, the church of God. And within you is the power of eternal life. But it's hidden from the world, is it not? We're not respected by the world. We're all viewed as but foolish by the world. And I'm an ugly guy, and we're an ugly crowd. We're not special. I love you. I'm glad we have each other. But as far as the world is concerned, let's face it, we're chattel. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. For consider your calling, brethren, for there's not many wise men called according to flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong and the base things of the world. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen. The things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are. There's a false vision that's out there. It's not reality. We are the reality. This is reality. This is the most important meeting in all of Redlands today. Hebrews 11, verse 37. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. Speaking of those that were faithful. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. All these, having gained the approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. And friends, we're not going to get it today. And may I dare say, we're not going to get it this week. Do not be despaired. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 6. Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor the rulers of this age, which is what? Which is passing away. Hillary, Donald, what? Passing away, friends. I'll have them on my staff. I need somebody to help set up the hall. They need that for a while. They'll learn some things. But we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, just like the book of Esther. The hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages of our glory. The wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Friends, the world does not recognize us. Like Gideon's little army, our little light is covered up in this clay pot. And it's waiting to be broken so that its glory may be shown. As we move forward here, post-spring holy days, as we move forward to the days of Pentecost, as we see God's plan working out, both in the physical, with the holy days, but in our own lives, as we step by step towards glory, let us keep the faith of the treasure of God that has been hidden into each and every single one of us. Let us stand tall in the face of persecution and the trials, which I assure you, friends, are coming. Let us stand tall. And fear not, little flock, is what Jesus said. Let us see ourselves as God sees us, made in His glorious image, to be the very children of God, and to be hidden no more. Brethren, let our light shine.